Hello, welcome to the podcast. My name's Ian Lewins, one of the consultant paediatricians based in Derby. And it's my very great pleasure to be joined today by Dr. Robert Scott-Jupp, who's a now retired consultant paediatrician based in Salisbury District Hospital. Good morning, Robert. How are you today?
Good morning, Ian. It's a pleasure to join your podcast.
Thank you. And we sort of got in contact to sort of chat about a paper that's being published in Archives of Disease in Childhood, which really caught my eye. And it's a paper that you've written along with Emily Carter and Nick Brown. And it's entitled The Effects of Consultant Residents Out of Hours on Acute Pediatric Admissions. What was the sort of background to this? Why did you guys decide to look at this piece of research and write this article?
Okay, well, before I talk about the actual study itself, I just want to set it in context, if I may, because going back to the 1990s, before there were really any hours of work regulations within the NHS and certainly none for consultants, nobody was doing resident on-call, although a lot of consultants were back then spending a lot of out-of-hours time, particularly in paediatrics, in hospitals. But there were really no rules about it at all, and there was no appropriate payment. What happened was, well, two things happened in the early 2000s. One was the first European Working Time Directive rules about junior doctors working, which I absolutely supported, and having worked horrendous hours when I was much younger myself, when I was training myself, I thought it was great that this was being enshrined in law. So that meant that you could not expect trainees, quite rightly, to work the sort of one in twos, one in threes that we did. And so that immediately led to a problem of providing adequate middle grade cover for small units where we didn't have that many trainees. And as you couldn't recruit huge numbers of trainees because there wouldn't be consultant jobs for them to go to, there was a cap on the number of trainees you could recruit. So how did you fill that gap? Well, that was the background. At the same time, the new consultant contract in the UK came in, and that allowed consultants who were doing a lot of work out of hours to be adequately remunerated and to have their hours regulated in a way that hadn't happened before. Previously, there was really no rules or any kind of convention on consultant hours. You just did the work that was necessary. You worked Monday to Friday, full working day, stayed late, came in at weekends and came in the middle of the night and got no recompense for it, either in terms of money or in terms of time off. So that was a huge change. That was a huge change, and that's what motivated it. What happened in our region, in the Wessex region, is in fact we weren't the first to consider consultant resident on call in paediatrics. And by the way, I don't think any other specialties were doing this at the time. I may be wrong about that, but I think paediatrics was amongst the first in the NHS. What happened, our neighbours in Dorchester down the road were doing it, but doing it in a rather different way to how we did it. And what made the difference is we waited for the new consultant contract to come in, then we could do it on a strictly contractual basis. And without wanting to go into the detail, it meant that we were paid a bit more for being, also more importantly, all time spent resident on call, whether you were actually working or not, counted as time working. And that was a big thing. So you could be sitting in your office or you could be asleep. And then if you were a resident on call, it counted as time working. And you got a slight pay enhancement for that if it was out of hours and very specific hours at nights and weekends. And that hadn't happened before. So we were able then to have a way of working that allowed consultants to be working out of hours in a reasonable way. From my point of view, and I was one of the first people to work it, from my point of view, the most important thing was actually having a guaranteed day off after the night on call. And that, at the time, was a big bonus because that didn't happen before. Previously, when I was non-resident on call, I might be called in for a prem baby in the middle of the night, be up all night resuscitating this baby, and then have to do a full day of clinics the next day. And that wasn't good for me, and it wasn't good for my patients. So that actual change was a big thing. It wasn't really about the money. It was more about the hours. And then having days off after a night on call at the time was a big bonus. I actually wrote an article about it, Ian, which was published in the BMJ Careers, actually, in 2005, which was fairly upbeat now, looking back at it, about how some of the positives about resident on call. So we were actually considered to be pariahs by some of our consultant colleagues, particularly in other specialties, as letting the side down and doing a terrible thing and setting a precedent. So that by doing this, we were going to devalue consultants, and all consultants are going to be just considered like SHOs and registrars. So we faced quite a lot of opposition, both from within paediatrics and from other specialties. However, I could see, and my colleagues could see, that really was the only way to maintain the service. The alternatives, which is what some people did, was to either cease 24-hour service completely and just be a daytime only, and then merge with a neighbouring unit. That was not geographically, that was not really an option for us. Other people employed non-consultant career grades to cover the shift, so lots of staff grades and trust doctors and people like that at middle grade level. That doesn't always work because these doctors tend to come and go, are often of variable quality, although some are very good, and it's not a particularly good career option for anybody. By doing it the way we did, we could pretty much guarantee high quality care for children out of hours, given that there was a consultant there. We still had middle grades. We didn't get rid of them. We had four registrars at the time who did some of the nights and weekends, and we did some of the nights and weekends on a complicated rota. So that was the background. Now, the timing of it is we started doing it in about 2005, I think, as I remember. And there weren't really enough of us, so when we started, only five of us. We went up to six consultants, and there still weren't really enough when there were six of us. The main downside of doing consultant resident on call was not enough time to do our daytime work, and that was the problem. Yeah. So it meant that as we were taking days off following nights, the outpatient clinic waiting times went up. There wasn't enough supervision on the wards during the day, and there just weren't enough of us around so during the day, and that was a problem. So a few years later, our trust, who was quite, I have to say, support the management, was very supportive about this, decided to expand the consultant numbers to 10. So we appointed four new consultants all in one go in 2009, and then with 10 of us on the rota. And because some people went part-time and so on, it got slightly more complicated, but basically 10 people doing it, it worked much better. So there were enough of us around during the day, and then we could all have much more satisfactory job plans. So that's how it worked. The questions that were asked right at the very beginning, not surprisingly by managers, is that it's expensive. How can you justify the cost? Well, from my point of view, I think you can justify the cost simply that children get better care, and that is enough. However, with a hard-headed financial hat on, you need to think whether there are actual possible savings. I always thought that consultants might be less likely to admit children. They might also be less likely to order investigations than more junior colleagues if they are the only more experienced doctor who sees the child at night, and that might actually save money. I wasn't at all sure whether it would justify the cost, the extra cost of employing consultants rather than registrars. So way back then, I even thought about it. So basically, this study is something I've been thinking about for 10 years before I did it. And so that's the background.
Yeah. And just sort of going back, when this was sort of first mooted,
yeah.
Was there sort of universal buy-in from the consultant body or
yes.
from resistance to it?
There was. And that's where I think in Salisbury, we were particularly lucky. One of my, when we very first started, my very senior colleagues who was about to retire didn't join in, but the five of us did. And then when he retired, his replacement then did join in. So that's why it was first five and then six. And we all bought in. And I might also add, one of the criticisms was that people said, nobody will want to work with you when if you force consultants to do resident on call. We didn't find that at all. In fact, two of my colleagues in the original six who did it, had already worked here as locums in Dorchester down the road. Just coincidentally, they happened to. And they willingly applied for jobs knowing that's what we do. And then the four new ones we appointed in 2009 all knew exactly what they were taking on. So we didn't have any problems, and we recruited extremely good people who are now well settled in And then since I retired, and there'd been a little wave of new recruitments as well, all of whom have gone into the job willingly, knowing and contracted actually to work resident out of hours. It's in their contracts.
Yeah, and I suppose it makes a difference if everybody's doing it. I think I wonder if there's a difference in mindset when you've got almost like a two-tier consultant system where some people do resident and some people don't.
Yes, yeah. Actually, Ian, that reminds me, there was a big meeting at the college about new consultant ways of working. And I'm trying to remember when it was. It was probably about 10 years ago. Probably around about 2010. So we've been doing it for a few years, other people think it. And I'm fairly sure there was a representation from Derby there, actually. But anyway, I don't think it was you. And different people talked about different ways of doing it. So I talked about how we did it in Salisbury. There were people from the Royal Free who were doing it rather differently. People from all over the country brought together. So, and it wasn't just about resident consultants. It was about other aspects. And a document came out. I don't know if it's still available. Quite an authoritative document on new ways of consultant working, which, of course, these days are not new anymore. Now they're pretty standard and routine.
Yeah. So in this study, then, you've kind of done a look back at essentially 10 years of data of on calls. And my understanding from this was actually it's not the consultant that's resident every single night. There's a mixture between your level two, level three sort of registrar grades and consultants. So the idea is to sort of say, look, okay, is there a difference in admission rates depending on who's on, basically?
That's right, yeah. And although it was not a randomised controlled trial, in practice it almost could have been, because the rota ground on in a rather complicated way, but it took no account of the day of the week or the time of year or the month or where we were in the junior doctor's rotations. It just ground on. So it was effectively randomised as to which night was which. And there's no way anybody referring a child in would have had any clue as to whether it was a resident consultant or resident registrar. So we were quite confident there were no biases in it, that the population we were dealing with was effectively randomised.
Right. So you know, you don't have person X always does the Monday, person Y always does the Tuesday.
I'll just go in a bit more detail about that. There was in that, because of weekdays and weekends, for most of the period, most of the weekday nights, Monday to Thursday, were consultant covered. Not all of them, but most of them. And in the weekends, it was half-half. It was about half the days and half the nights were consultant or middle grade, respectively. The reason why we had that bias towards consultants doing nights during the weekdays was primarily educational, to allow our middle grades to attend more daytime duties during the week, clinics, ward rounds, all the other stuff that you need to do to complete your training. So we actually deliberately designed it that way to facilitate training of middle grades.
So when you were sort of looking at the data, were you looking at, you know, numbers, purely sort of numbers admitted and how long these people were admitted for, depending on whether it was consultant or middle grade?
Yes. We decided to, first of all, it was going to be impossible to look at diagnoses or any kind of measure, clinical measure of degree of illness. That was just, we just didn't have the data for that, and to, you know, pull the notes of thousands of children was clearly going to be unfeasible. So we just went on what data was readily available on the current hospital systems, which is probably no different to any other hospital admission system. So we had time of admission, we had duration of admission, and anyone will know who's done this sort of thing is that these aren't terribly accurate, and that there are all sorts of errors because people don't put the actual time in and that sort of thing. But all these errors don't really matter because they're going to be the same for both groups. There's no reason why there should be more errors on consultant nights than registrar nights. This sort of data's put in by admin staff and nurses, so it really doesn't really make any difference to that. So I admit that probably there are inaccuracies in the data, but they should balance out. Well, what we decided to do as a measure of, so just go back a stage. So if there was the hypothesis is that a less experienced doctor is more likely to admit a child who wasn't very ill rather than sending them home during the night or weekend compared to a consultant who might send that same child home. In other words, a less confident doctor might want to keep the child in overnight. So by looking at those that were less ill, we chose to take those that stayed less than 12 hours overall, because it's easy to access that data, on the assumption that if they came in at, say, I don't know, maybe 11 o'clock or midnight one night, they would be seen on the ward round the next morning, probably at 9, and sent home within 12 hours if there wasn't much wrong with them, some perhaps even earlier than that, perhaps at 7 or 8 in the morning. So we thought that the sort of, if you want to say the trivial illness, although obviously it's not trivial to parents, but if you want to use that word, those ones were the ones. So that's why we made that division. And a substantial number were, I can't remember that number, a substantial minority were less than 12-hour admissions. And I think you probably find that on many children's units. And anyway, the results showed that the difference, although none of the differences were that great, the difference was greater in the those that stayed less than 12 hours between the in theoretically iller children who stayed more than 12 hours.
Yes. So, I mean, looking at the results, you've obviously got data grouped into kind of slightly different groups. So there's resident, consultant, present or not, two groups. Time of day, weekend, day or night as two groups, and then your length of stay as less than or more than 12 hours, which seems sort of very sensible. Yeah. And I was interested that you, the way that you've presented, so in the table in the paper, the summary is a summary of admissions with IRRs. Why did you choose to present it that way?
Oh, we had a lot of discussion about the statistics, and I have to say this is the result of several iterations through peer review, and also my colleague Nick Brown, who is considerably more knowledgeable and expert at statistical things than I am. So the simple answer, it was his advice, and it was accepted by the peer reviewers, whereas on an earlier draft, and I won't go into detail, we used slightly different statistical tests that the statistical peer review was less happy with. But IIRs are just a way of just explaining the odds of being admitted. And they're not great. So for all admissions, the IIR is 1.07, which means you're only, I suppose you could say in terms, you're 7% more likely to be admitted if you come in on a registrar night than a consultant night, which isn't that much. But because that we've got quite big numbers, it means the 95% confidence intervals are relatively narrow at 1.04 to 1.09, and it gives a surprisingly high p-value for what seems like a small difference. But that's because, in fact, going back to what I was saying, waiting 10 years to do this study, I mean, there were all sorts of reasons why it took so long, but it did mean we'd accumulated a lot of data by then. I think if we'd done it after maybe only 3 or 4 or 5 years, we wouldn't have got anything significant, because you need lots of numbers to get this level of statistical significance.
So that's kind of the bottom line, isn't it? That the standout number is this sort of 7% difference between resident and non-resident. Did time, I don't know if you looked at it, but did time of year sort of influence this?
No, we didn't look at that actually, and that was something picked up by the peer reviewers. It would have been difficult in practice to go back and gather that data. With hindsight, we probably should have got it at the first case when we first started out, but we didn't gather the data when extracting it in the first place. But again, there's no real reason why. I mean, obviously numbers will be greater in the winter than the summer, but it'll affect both kinds of nights equally. So I would be surprised if that was a major factor, to be honest.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing that came into my mind, as well as sort of time of year, which I guess is related, is whether, and again, it's very difficult to look at this, whether the sort of bed occupancy influenced people's decision. You know, in winter when there's very few beds, the bronchiolytic who's borderline, you might send home, versus if I've got lots of beds, I might keep them in.
Absolutely. It would have absolutely, and it always does, and a lot of the time, in fact, possibly most of the time, I think anyone working in an acute paediatric unit will be aware of this, you're always worried about filling up, particularly at night. But again, there's no reason why that should have affected registrar nights any differently to consultant nights, so that should all just balance out.
In terms of sort of the registrars making those decisions, are all those registrars that you had sort of at similar levels of training, or again,
no, they do vary. And I might actually just point out, and this is a confession, there's a slight error in the methods pointed out by one of my colleagues, is that I say in the methods that the ST grade, middle grades were ST 4 to 8, but in fact there were some ST3s as well on the middle grade rota. But anyway, that's just a minor thing. So no, they weren't. They are just the way that our registrar rotations, they vary, anything from ST3 up to ST8 or even ST8 plus sometimes. And it's random. It depends on just, well, you know how it is with allocation of posts. It depends who's available and who's around. And some of them would have been locums as well, with a lot of locums filling in.
Yeah. I think the really interesting question that this raises is the economic one. And, you know, from a manager's perspective, is, you know, we believe that you'll get better care, but I guess, is 7% worth paying the consultants versus the middle grades? That's kind of the tricky question to answer, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. This is just one small aspect of the whole thing, and I would hate anyone to think that this is the be-all and end-all of it. There are many other ways you could study this, and I hope somebody does. So, as I've already mentioned, use of investigations. Again, that probably isn't enough to justify economically, but doing fewer investigations at night is probably a good thing. But perhaps far more importantly, that is patient and parent satisfaction. And we haven't done that. Maybe we should, with hindsight, have had some sort of post-admission follow-up and asked people what they thought of the care they received, without necessarily telling them that we were comparing consultants and registrars, and just see if the doctor you saw, what you thought of them. And that's probably another study. It's very difficult to look at long-term outcomes because, as you know, most kids just get better anyway, whatever you do. So I don't think it would be to looking at things like sort of serious outcomes like intensive care admission and deaths, which isn't going to get you very far because there were so few. But things like parent and patient outcome and asking the kids themselves, I think would be very useful.
Yeah, as you say, as the paper sort of says, you know, admission rate isn't necessarily a reflection of quality by any means, is it?
Yeah. And another outcome measure, which I could also add in is asking our tier one doctors, the SHOs, if I'm still allowed to use the term SHO, what they thought. My feeling is that they were universally positive and they very much enjoyed being on call with only a consultant. Nothing against registrars, but I think they mostly valued it. Certainly that's what came over, and we got very good ratings in our GMC survey thing as well.
Yeah, I think one interesting from my perspective aspect of this is that the idea of role modelling as consultants, and obviously paediatrics is going through a bit of a crisis at the moment in recruitment, and people are looking. You know, I look after foundation trainees locally, and people look at paediatrics and go, "Well, I don't fancy it compared to GP for a couple of reasons. Reason one, it's a long training, and the college is recognised that and is doing something about it. But my goodness, look at the amount of time that the consultants are in hospital compared to the other hospital specialities.
Yeah.
No thanks. Do you think this sort of paper adds to that discussion?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I don't really know what you could do about it. So I should just say I'm also in my sort of semi-retirement involved peripherally with the RCPCH's initiative to try and improve working lives for trainee paediatricians. And Hilary Cass has just launched a big thing called the CoLab, which is specifically about this, and particularly around extremely ill children and difficult decisions and so on. It is, and recruitment is a problem. I believe that paediatrics is now right down the bottom of the recruitment ratio table, which is a huge issue and a real problem for us. I mean, going back to what I was saying at the beginning, as far as I'm concerned, for people of my generation, this was so much better than what went before. But of course, that means nothing to people coming to the specialty now. There's no point of comparing it to what we were doing back in the 1990s. You have to compare it with what people are doing in other specialties these days. I think there are many other things that you could do to make paediatricians' working lives better, both at junior level and senior level. But I think going back to the days of having very exposed, inexperienced doctors on their own in acute units at night is not the way forward, because it's far worse, it's terrifying, and mistakes get made and children get damaged. I mean, that is the reality, where people who are expected to take on responsibility, they're not ready for. And as you well know, paediatrics is not a specialty where you can wait 20 minutes for a consultant to come in from home if an unexpectedly flat baby gets born. So you do need resident skilled cover. Is it putting people off? I think it is the nature of the specialty, and you think if you want to stay in acute paediatrics or neonatal paediatrics, you have to accept that. I don't think there's any way around that. Of course, there are other career options. You can go into more community-based work, but if you want to stay in acute, you have to do that. And all you can do is make the conditions that you're working out of hours as enjoyable as possible.
Yeah. A final question then, Robert. If you were to sort of go back to 2005 and having experienced this on-call rota, would you do it again? Would you sort of say, yes, this is the right thing to do?
Yeah, I would, but I definitely. And I, at the time I started doing it, for me personally, it was a lifestyle transformation. Having worked previously sort of all day, every day, Monday to Friday, with not even half days off, and then often staying very late in the evening, suddenly I had days off in the week, which was a complete novelty. I could do normal stuff like go to the bank and pick my kids up from school, which I've never had that before. So, you know, for me, but I know that is that's history now, that's no longer relevant. But I would. However, having said that, I think there's an age issue here, Ian, and I should now confess that I actually came off the resident on-call rota myself when I was in my late 50s. And I think that, and there was no rules about this. There were no guidelines from the BMA or the NHS or anyone else. So fortunately, my colleagues and managers were sympathetic and allowed me to come off. So in my 40s, I was enthusiastic about it. In my 50s, I became much less enthusiastic about it. And that's simply age-related. It's just biology. You just don't tolerate sleepless nights as well when you get older. So I think, yes, but I think there needs to be formal policy from somebody that you're allowed to opt out maybe at the age of 50 or 55. And I believe other specialties are doing that at the moment.
Yeah, I guess, you know, you get more buy-in if people see there's an end point.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So I think that should be written into people's contracts, actually. If you're going to have a contract that specifies resident on-call, I think, you know, the specific age, you should be able to opt out.
Okay. Robert, thank you very much. That's been absolutely fascinating. And this article is available now online first and will be appearing shortly in archives.
Okay, it's a pleasure. It's good to speak to you, Ian.
Okay, thank you so much.